The Bible reading this morning is from Deuteronomy chapters 9 and 10, first part of Deuteronomy 9 and the second half of Deuteronomy 10. Moses continues his address to the people of Israel before they cross the Jordan to enter the Promised Land. And his concern particularly is to make them understand that the success they're about to experience is not a reward for their own righteousness. Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 1. Hear, Israel. You are now about to cross the Jordan to go in and dispossess nations greater and stronger than you, with large cities that have walls up to the sky. The people are strong and tall, Anakites. You know about them. And have heard it said, who can stand up against the Anakites? But be assured today that the Lord your God is the one who goes ahead of you like a devouring fire. He will destroy them. He will subdue them before you. And you will drive them out and annihilate them quickly, as the Lord has promised you. After the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, the Lord has brought me here to take possession of this land because of my righteousness. No, it is on account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out before you. It is not because of your righteousness or your integrity that you are going in to take possession of their land. But on account of the wickedness of these nations, the Lord your God will drive them out before you, to accomplish what he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Understand then that it is not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God is giving you this good land to possess. For you are a stiff-necked people. Remember this, and never forget how you aroused the anger of the Lord your God in the wilderness. From the day you left Egypt until you arrived here, you have been rebellious against the Lord. At Horeb, you aroused the Lord's wrath, so that he was angry enough to destroy you. When I went up on the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant that the Lord had made with you, I stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. I ate no bread and drank no water. The Lord gave me 2 stone tablets inscribed by the finger of God. On them were all the commandments the Lord proclaimed to you on the mountain, out of the fire, on the day of the assembly. At the end of the 40 days and 40 nights, the Lord gave me the 2 stone tablets, the tablets of the covenant. Then the Lord told me, go down from here at once, because your people, whom you brought out of Egypt, have become corrupt. They have turned away quickly from what I commanded them, and have made an idol for themselves. The reading continues over the page. Moses goes into greater length about their history of failure. And then he concludes in chapter 10 and verse 12. And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in obedience to him, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to observe the Lord's commands and decrees that I am giving you today for your own good. To the Lord your God belong the heavens, even the highest heavens, the earth and everything in it. Yet the Lord set his affection on your ancestors and loved them. And he chose you, their descendants, above all the nations, as it is today. Circumcise your hearts, therefore, and do not be stiff-necked any longer. For the Lord your God is God of gods, and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow, and loves the foreigner residing among you, giving them food and clothing. And you are to love those who are foreigners, for you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt. Fear the Lord your God and serve him. Hold fast to him and take your oaths in his name. He is the one you praise. He is your God who performed for you those great and awesome wonders you saw with your own eyes. Your ancestors who went down into Egypt were 70 in all. And now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars in the sky. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Well, good morning. My name is Prash. I'm one of the assistant ministers here, and it's good to be preaching this morning. If you're new, I'll be at the door and it'd be nice to meet you there. Now, we're kind of halfway through a series in Deuteronomy. We're not looking at every verse and chapter of the book, and rather we're kind of picking up passages which explore key themes that you find in the book of Deuteronomy. And this morning we turned to Deuteronomy chapter 9 and chapter 10. And as we do that, I just want to start us off by doing a little, mental puzzle. I want to ask you to fill in the blank of this sentence. A corporation is inclined to or focused on. A corporation is inclined to or focused on ... How would you finish that sentence? Corporation is inclined to maximizing profits, for example. A school is inclined to or focused on. A school is inclined to ... How would you finish that sentence? Educating children, cultivating excellence. How about religion is inclined to, is focused on? Religion is inclined to ... What would you use to finish that sentence? I don't pretend to know what everyone would say, but I suspect a lot of people in the building might complete that sentence. A religion is inclined to worshipping God or the supreme being. There are probably people in this building who aren't Christians but have some sense of the religious, and so they think religion is about worshipping that supreme being. Maybe you're not religious, but you've just come to see religious people and that's what you think you'll see. And look, to a large extent, that is really what we're about. When we talk about religion, when we talk about the Christian faith, when people are here in this building, they're here focused on worshipping God. And you really find that focus throughout the two passages that we read this morning. At the start of the second passage, chapter 10, verses 12 and 13, we actually see Moses, who wrote Deuteronomy, entreating the Israelites to worship God with a fivefold direction. He says, fear the Lord, walk in obedience to him, love him, serve the Lord, and observe the Lord's commands. So really a vertical sense. Religion and religious practice is to a great extent about that relationship with God, about interacting with God, about worshipping God. So if you completed the sentence, religion is inclined to, with words to the effect of worshipping God, then certainly that's what a lot of this chapter and a lot of these chapters is focused on. But is there more to it than that? Is it inclined to more than just that? One author in his commentary on the book of James says that true and acceptable religion is inclined to the needy. True and acceptable religion is inclined to the needy. And I wonder if you'd agree. Perhaps you're in one of two camps. You hear me say that and raises the hairs on the back of your head. You think, where are we going today? Or perhaps you think, oh, finally, someone's talking about it. True and acceptable religion is inclined to the needy. And in fact, I think when you look at these two chapters, there's lots of talk about worshipping God and focusing on him. But I think one of the key verses that emerges out of this chapter is at verse 19 in chapter 10. Where God, through Moses, commands his people to love those who are foreigners. To love those who are foreigners. And actually, if you survey Scripture, Old and New Testament, this idea resonates throughout Scripture, pops up regularly. This idea of foreigners, actually, it often appears in a four-part list, in the Old Testament at least. These were people who didn't have any of the kind of socioeconomic structures to keep them safe. Things like family or a land or any form of inheritance or maybe even work. The list included people like orphans, widows, foreigners, and the poor. And the closest equivalent we might find in our cultural time is the refugee, although it's tempting to simply kind of identify with them and say, okay, those are the people that God's speaking of. But I think he's talking about a larger group of people. He's talking about people in our time and place who don't have those kind of those structures around them. They might be homeless. They might be couch surfers. They might be long-term unemployed. They might be new migrants. In other words, it's a broad group of people who have, in our cultural terms at least, not really made it yet, or perhaps even failed. They're people who don't have the kind of security that most of us in this building are accustomed to. And this group and this focus on this group repeats throughout the book of Deuteronomy and indeed throughout the Old Testament. Deuteronomy, for example, in Deuteronomy 14, a couple of chapters forward, Deuteronomy is, after all, a list of laws and stipulations by God to his people, things you should do as God's people. And he says, when you give food for the priests, Deuteronomy 14, he says, you should also set some aside for the foreigner. Deuteronomy 16, he says, foreigners are to enjoy the benefits of a feast time. The great moment of celebration in Israel's communal life is also meant to be a time which invites the foreigner in their midst into that. In Deuteronomy 26, he says, when you give your tithe, that's when you set aside your giving to the temple, you're to set aside part of that to the poor and the foreigner in your midst. And then as a culmination almost, Deuteronomy 31, God says, even the law, even that most intimate of exchanges between him and his people is something which the foreigner should also have access to. We see two great examples of this as the Old Testament rolls out in Rahab, firstly, the prostitute in Jericho, who, having sided with God's people before they attack Jericho, is enfolded into the community. And in Ruth, who is a foreigner, who ends up being widowed and comes to Israel as a poor woman and is enfolded again into the community of God. But even more than that, in those two stories are not just two individuals who are brought into the communal life of Israel, but ultimately when we get to the New Testament, we see they're actually brought into the story of the gospel. They're actually part of the genealogy, the family line of Jesus himself. What better example we find of God saying the foreigner is at the center, actually, of the communal life of Israel. Now, this is startling when you think about it because, as we were talking about last week, if you were in church, God is transcendent. He accepts no equals. In fact, he said to the Israelites as they went into the promised land, you are not to tolerate any foreign nations. Any of those who might worship foreign gods, you're meant to destroy. He would not allow equals in terms of gods or kings or nations. He stood above all of them. His point being that he is the one and only God. He is transcendent. And yet in this command, we find the startling reality that that God, who will not accept equals, loves the foreigner. And rather than spiritualize that, when that comes across into the New Testament, rather than say, okay, well, now I want you to put that in your hearts, Jesus actually says, he crystallizes, says, when you treat one of the poor well, you treat me well. Matthew 25, verse 40 says, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. You did for me. And so a quick survey of the Bible says that God is about the poor. God is about the displaced. God is about the foreigner. God is about the person who has no financial or relational security. And to a large extent, the church has over the ages taken this on board. If you look at most organisations that provide welfare, both here in Australia and in other countries, they find their genesis point in a Christian or a group of Christians who started them up. Unfortunately, often you look at an organization and they've moved away from the gospel, but the thing that started them and inclined them to the needy and the poor and those who were oppressed or those who were struggling with poverty was the gospel, was their Christian faith. However, the danger of me even saying that is that we all say, hear, hear, and then move on. The challenge is not just a communal challenge, but a personal challenge. There are individual Israelites hearing Moses issue these commands. There is a Facebook group for the Save Darfur campaign. At one stage, that Facebook group had over 1 million likes, but at the same time had raised only $100,000. Now, I'm no mathematician or actuary, but my limited maths tells me that not many people gave not very much money. In fact, they estimated 98% of the people who were apparently following or liking that campaign had done nothing for it in reality. One author says, many people have what you'd call a social concern, but it hasn't translated into their personal lives. A social concern, but it has not affected their personal lives. And it's actually worth at this point just pausing and reflecting and asking ourselves whether that is actually a stark truth about ourselves as well. Reflect on the way we use our money. Think about how much money you might spend on your child's education, and then reflect on how much you spend on those who are less fortunate than you. Or think about the time that we spend driving our children from activity to activity, and how much time we then spend on those who are less fortunate. Or consider your house, how much energy you might spend talking about or investing in the renovation of your property. But then who are the people that we open our doors to? Who experiences the renovated property that we live in? And if you ask those questions honestly and genuinely of yourself, you may be like me and feel quite overwhelmed by the reality that even if true religion is inclined to the needy, our hearts often aren't. We often aren't inclined, certainly in practice. We might have a social concern, but it has not affected our personal lives. Often what stops us, I think, is twofold. We have a certain anxiety. We might say to ourselves, my needs are more important than their needs. After all, I can barely pay my rent. Some people have that experience. Or I need to pay those school fees. Or we need a bigger house. Or I want to take the family on that overseas trip that we haven't been on. So how can I set aside money for someone else when these needs are yet to be met? Or maybe just more fundamentally, we have bought into a meritocratic culture which teaches us a lie that you are what you've earned. We've become dull to those truths that say who we are and what we've received are actually often a product of things we've done nothing to deserve. That we've forgotten the fact that we've been born into a family that has wealth, or we live in a time and a place that's secure, or we've been given an intellect which allows us to earn a certain income. We've believed a lie that you get what you earn. And you might say, well, I'm not sure if that's me, but if you reflect, if these kind of phrases come out, if only they just got a job, or if they just knuckled down and worked harder, or don't skip the line, or wait your turn. If those words come out, or even if they just ruminate in your head when you encounter those who are more needy than you, then you have a heart which has become deadened to the needs of those around us. In fact, for Israel, despite this being the strong emphasis of the law, They themselves, by the time Jesus had come around, had made these very mistakes. And Jesus, when he comes and he challenges the leaders, the religious leaders of his time, one of the key things he constantly points to is their failure to understand and show compassion for those who are lowly and more needy than them. He writes in Matthew writes in chapter 23, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites." This is Jesus speaking, and he's speaking to people who know Deuteronomy 10. I mean, it's not a fisherman who might think, oh, look, they forgot that verse. These guys, if you remember Jansen's sermon from a couple of weeks ago, these guys, they memorized this stuff. It was written and then hanging off their hair. They knew these laws. He says, "You hypocrites, you give a tenth of your spices." In other words, you're legalistic, but you have neglected the heart of the law. You have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. The very things that we comprehend in our own hearts is the reality of Israel that Jesus encounters. So how do we make a social concern, something we're all happy to say here too, a personal concern? Well, it is interesting in Moses' words, he doesn't simply issue them with a command in this chapter. He doesn't just say, go and love the foreigner. But he surrounds it with a couple of truths, a couple of invitations is how I describe it, to kind of motivate them and transform their heart on this issue. First invitation, I phrase as this, Israel, know yourself. Know yourself, Israel. John Calvin, the 1500s reformer, at the start of his big chunk of doctrine called the Institutes, starts with these words, "Without the knowledge of self, there is no knowledge of God." He's not talking about, you know, some kind of self-actualization. He's saying without knowing yourself truly as you are, you actually can't even know God. And so Moses' point is Israel will identify and care for the poor and the outsider when they have rightly identified themselves. When they've rightly understood themselves. If you look in chapter 9, verse 7, Moses says, remember. And the heart of the remembrance is to remember what they have done in the past, the mistakes they've made. In fact, verses 7 through 12 is Moses recounting that moment at the base of Mount Horeb when he had gone up to receive the law, this precious and personal thing written by, he says, God's own finger. Meanwhile, Israel down the bottom building themselves a golden calf. Golden calf. And Moses says, do not forget that moment of rebellion. And it wasn't just a one-off, of course. It continues, this continual grumbling to this very point in history. And Moses says, don't forget that. In fact, remembering is the key to obedience. Paul says, 1 Timothy 1, I am the chief of sinners. He is the apostle of grace. And yet he has never forgotten where he has come from. See, remembrance is so important. It moves the heart away from pride. And pride is the thing that holds us back from obedience. Moses' point is be slow to judge the foreigner in your midst because you yourself were worthy of judgment. Self-righteousness might restrict their generosity, but when they remember who they really are, it should free them up. It should take away the hurdles which hold them back. You know, a true view of yourself breaks down a meritocratic view. It breaks down a sense of you have earned this. You're worthy of your particular position of blessing. And secondly, he also says, not just remember your sin, but remember your fundamental identity. Remember that you are yourselves foreigners. Remember, in the immediate context of verse 19 and that command to love the foreigner is a remembrance of their own identity. If they just think back 50 years, they themselves were slaves in Egypt. Foreigners in a land with no land of their own to speak of. No inheritance under the rule of a foreign king. If they think even further back to Genesis and the patriarchs, all their great forefathers were wandering men and women who had no land to speak of, who ruled over no people. And again, his point is, if you yourself for so much of your history have been an outsider, how could you not love the outsider? If you have been a foreigner, If you have been in exile, how can you not love the foreigner in your midst? And of course, you push forward a few hundred years after this moment in Deuteronomy, again, they will be in exile. You see, exile and being outside of your place of belonging is often the experience of God's people. How can you not love those people who have no place of belonging? However, Israel needed to know not just themselves, they needed to know God rightly too. And so his second invitation I describe as Israel, know your God. Know your God. And he brings out two particular characteristics of God, two realities about God in these passages. First of all, chapter 10, verse 18, he defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the foreigner residing among you, giving them food and clothing. God is, that's going to be a problem. God is the God who's transcendent. He's transcendent and powerful. But here he is loving the foreigner in his midst. Loving the foreigner. When you think of all the powerful people that you encounter, their greatest concern is for the people who might feed their power, for the developers and the shareholders. But here God is who is a God of the poor. And what's more, God doesn't just love the poor, he loves Israel, who themselves have such a checkered history. He is the God who loved them despite their disobedience. See in verse 15, he says, the Lord set his affection on your ancestors. When he says that, who's he thinking of? He's thinking of the very people who built the calf at the base of Mount Horeb. And so what we come to see when we reflect on these two characteristics of God, the fact that he loves the poor, and what's more, he loves Israel, that land, that nation that was not just small, but rebellious, not just weak, but wicked. When you see these two things coming together, you start to understand a reality about God, that he loves unlikely people. And the key to unlocking compassion, Moses says, is when your right understanding of yourself and your right understanding of God intersect. When you come to see that you're not as good as you think, Israel, and you come to see that God is better than you deserve, then you are ready to be generous, truly generous. It's interesting, isn't it? Israel are not to be motivated simply by the example of God's character, although that would be a legitimate way to motivate them. They are not to be motivated simply by God's commands. God said you should be generous, therefore be generous. That also would be a legitimate way to be motivated. They're to be motivated by the very experience of God's character, that they themselves have experienced God's kindness to them. So the question, though, is how does Israel's story relate to us? How does Israel's story relate to us? And when we come to understand it through the lens of the gospel of Jesus Christ, we come to see what's true for them is even more true for us. So in the gospel, we come to both know ourselves rightly and know God truly. And that changes the way we think about generosity. It changes and transforms us and gives us the ability to love those who are more needy than us. When you look at the cross of Jesus Christ, you get an insight into who you really are. When you look at the cross of Jesus Christ and you see hanging on that cross the Son of God, beaten, mocked, and humiliated, bleeding and suffering to death, for your sake, you don't just see a moment in history, you see an insight into your own and my heart, your heart, my heart. You see the blackness of it. When Israel are at the base of the mountain and they're rebelling against God, they're making a golden calf. But when the world is rebelling against God, they're nailing his Son to the cross. And that says something very profound about our hearts. It shows us something that's really true about us, that our hearts are dark. We can't uphold any kind of vision that says the good things we have, we've earned. When we look at the cross of Jesus Christ, we realize that what we'd really earned is what he is bearing at that moment on the cross. But of course, the cross also shows us the profound and wonderful reality of who God is. It shows us that he's more loving and kind and generous than we deserve. See, the cross is the moment when God doesn't just say to Israel, love the poor and the oppressed and the alien. He becomes the poor and the oppressed and the alien. He bears the full weight of that identity so that we don't have to, so that we don't have to stand on the edge, so that we don't have to experience what it is to be excluded, but so that we are drawn in. And all of this means something. It means something. It means that the anxieties and the uncertainties which hold us back from generosity are unnecessary, because we are in the hands of a good and kind God who would spend what is most precious for himself, for you. It frees us to not worry about those things, but to give them up for the sake of another. And it says that God really is good. You do not have to be suspicious about him. You do not have to be suspicious about him. Now, having said all this, the temptation is simply to allow this all to remain a social concern and not for it to flow in and affect us personally. And so I want to challenge you, if you're someone who's hearing this word from the Lord and you say to yourself, I really need to think hard about how I spend my money or my time or my energy. I really need to see a greater focus on those who are needy in my life. Then one of the things you can do is you can scribble on the, there wasn't meant to be a box, but communication failed this week, but scribble on the tear-off slip. I'd like to respond to the sermon, and I will send you, it's just a one-page sheet, has a list of different ministries, both run more globally and also run by St. James, which might be things you want to tie into. Secondly, you might be interested in tying in and helping with the Buzz Group. If you were here a few months ago, you'd remember that the Buzz Group, which has run for many years, ministry to people with intellectual disabilities, is kind of on a hiatus as the people who've run it have had to finish up, and we're looking for someone to take that on. Now, at the time, you might have thought, great ministry, really worthwhile. But maybe the Lord is laying it on your heart in this moment that this is the ministry where you might spend yourself for someone who is needy. Ultimately, though, whatever decision we make must be motivated by the gospel. And so I want to finish with these words from a 18th century Scottish preacher who entreats his hearers to generosity. And he addresses often the things that we throw up which might stop us from being generous, and he meets each objection with the gospel. This is what he says. He says, "You must be like Christ in giving. Though he was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor. Objection 1, my money is my own. Answer, Christ might have said, my blood is my own, my life is my own. Then where should we have been? Objection 2, the poor are undeserving. Answer, Christ might have said, they are wicked rebels. Shall I lay down my life for these? I will give to the good angels. But no, he left the 99 and came after the lost. He gave his blood for the undeserving. Objection 3. The poor may abuse it. Answer. Christ might have said the same. Yea, with far greater truth, Christ knew that thousands would trample his blood under their feet, that most would despise it, that many would make it an excuse for sinning. Yet he gave his own blood. Oh, my dear Christians, if you would be like Christ, give much, give often, give freely to the vile, the poor, the thankless, and the undeserving. Christ is glorious and happy, and so will you be. Amen.